Welcome to New Persuasive Words, a podcast of hope seeking understanding. Join Scott Jones and Bill Bohr for an ongoing conversation about theology, culture, and politics. Funny, contentious, outrageous, there's something for everyone. And now, your hosts.
Welcome back to New Persuasive Words. I'm Scott Jones.
And I'm Bill Bohr.
Here we are, Bill. We're experimenting. We've got new recording software today.
Very nice. I know. It's the journey that we've been on. We continue to discover new ways to do this, right?
Hey, we will not be stopped. We're like the post office, but better dressed.
Well, yeah, I guess. Yeah. It's funny. Getting mail in Vermont is a bit of an adventure.
I don't want my mail to be an adventure. Many things in life I want to be an adventure.
It's a little bit of adventure. For a while they would not tell us. They wouldn't tell us they were keeping packages they didn't deliver. And for a while, our local post office here in Arlington was shut down because there was some sort of toxic leak.
That's not an adventure. That's a hazard.
That is a hazard. Yeah. And technically, because we're on a private road, UPS is not supposed to come up, but we have a good guy who does anyway. And so my favorite thing is, you know, it's I joined the Wild Alaskan Fish Club, by the way. This is a promo. I'm giving them they could be one of our new advertisers. Wild Alaska Fish, and it's like sustainable fishing, and they send it to me in dry ice. But one of the funniest things I found was the first time they sent it to me was I went down to the mailbox. So this is kind of bear territory, and so I had salmon tied to my mailbox in a box, and I thought, fortunately, I guess it was sealed pretty well with dry ice, everything. But I thought, wow. This could be like a bear bait here. So I didn't have to wrestle.
I would not consider any of these things positives. You're not selling Vermont here.
I'm looking out every morning. I look out at one of the most beautiful views I've ever seen. And the leaves are starting to change a little bit. So there are trade-offs. I've only seen evidence of the bear here on our property. I haven't seen a straight up bear. Had a family of coyotes for a while. That was fun. I kind of said that was my. I owned a dog. I had wild coyotes that would walk through my property. So that's kind of what's going on up here in the Green Mountain State. So,
well, I'll tell you what. Since we've maybe last spoken or it was developing, there's now a feud that has started between Bill Maher and Howard Stern, and Donald Trump has weighed in. So, I mean, this is the trifecta.
Of the three of those people, there's only one of them that I actually would care to listen to.
That would be Stern, I'm guessing.
Yes, right. Yeah, I find him a wonderful interviewer and interesting. One of those I don't really ever want to listen to again. And the other person, I've always been on him. Meh, as your favorite expression. I'm kind of meh.
I have seen Bill Maher in person. He was really, really, I thought he was excellent. I was actually surprised that he was as good a stand up as he was. Cause I sort of knew him as the host of the HBO show.
Yeah. He started out on stand up. Actually, he was in a really bad movie one day. I can't remember what it was.
He was in DC Cab, right?
Or something like that. Yeah. But at any rate, well, he's got his niche and sometimes I find him interesting.
He gets very good guests.
Oh yeah, and I kind of like the gadfly. I like a curse on everyone's houses. You know, I enjoy that position, but I just find him tiresome. I'll be honest with you.
Well, he said something about Howard Stern gushing on about his second wife, and he said, right. You know, do we have to do this? Don't the first wife's still alive? She can hear. And Stern replied, said he was sexist, and then Trump blasted Stern in an early morning post on his social media platform, Truth Social, which I am on, by the way. I don't sign on to it very often, but I'm on it. Calling Stern a broken weirdo, unattractive, both inside and out, trying like hell to be relevant.
Wow. There we go. Well, you know, I think, Howard was pretty blunt about what he thought about Donald Trump. of who he was when he enjoyed him. And then the, and I think Stern, among other people, you know, called it right. I mean, Trump never thought he was going to get elected. It was a business opportunity.
Stern said it was a book promo opportunity. Yeah. not book promo. He said it was, and I think he was right about this. At that time, Trump was like the highest paid personality on TV or something. And he was renegotiating his contract for The Apprentice. So Stern said he goes on to do this as a goof to sort of get up his stock and kind of, you know, promote himself and add more value to his name. And he had no idea that he would actually win the nomination. I mean,
I think of The Apprentice, and I never watched an episode live, but I do think of Gilbert Godfrey of blessed memory. I've seen it. I've watched it on YouTube, and his making fun of Trump is worth the deep dive into the abyss there. Yeah, there's another fun comedian who no longer is with us.
One time was that when Howard Stern and we left, he spit on all the donuts. He was just a strange guy.
I'm still my favorite. We weren't recording, but we were not recording. We were on a hiatus when Norm Macdonald died, I believe.
Wow, another great.
Yeah, one of my
favorites. Died kind of young, it seems to me, but.
Yeah, cancer. Yeah, he's in his mid-60s or whatever.
Well, there we go, Bill. We give everybody their daily dose of people. By the way, I want to thank everybody on Facebook. We posted our last episode. Thank you for all the warm wishes. I mean, people were really thrilled that we're back, and we're happy to.
That's nice. I keep getting these. I don't know if it's real or not because I can never get to the source where I'm being punished by Facebook because I said I've broken some sort of copyright law. So I'm not sure what that's about. And every time I try to, I have to admit, I'll start to try to explore it and then I don't really care. And so I stop, but I've never been able to get quite an answer if that's real or not. So still the Resident Exile Facebook page still seems to be out there, but I might be in Facebook prison. I don't know. Well,
it's better than a Chinese prison where
Chinese, Mexican,
where I'm sure,
or Turkish, right?
You can't see these headphones I'm wearing, but I got these at a corner store for $7. I'm sure made in a Chinese prison by some political dissident's child.
I visited a prison in Ghana, and they actually were so overcrowded that you had to sleep in shifts. It was really a horrific situation. But anyway, not a good thing. So
I don't like sleeping in shifts. I mean, I want my 7 hours straight through. Although I have slept on a flatbed in Haiti on virtually no roads. I can sleep anywhere.
Well, I can't. I'm very bad. They sleep in shifts in submarines. Another place I don't really choose to volunteer for. That's a unique particular calling.
So, absolutely. And I've watched this year, I have rewatched Crimson Tide and The Hunt for Red October, both excellent submarines.
I tell you, Das Boot
in German.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest films ever made. So
Bill, today is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, so we thought, who has more to atone for than you and I?
Yeah.
but aside from that fact, we thought it would be fitting if we spoke a little bit on the atonement, Bill. So on this day where, people, it's sundown to sundown because we're on a lunar calendar in the Jewish liturgical calendar. This is the Day of Atonement where people make, atonement for their sins. You're supposed to, I think, on the day before, isn't there tradition that you make atonement to people before you make atonement to God, that you have to get your sort of horizontal before the vertical?
I don't know the order. I was at a very long service last night.
What is very long? Let's, because this is relative.
It was 2 hours.
Two hours is very long by any liturgy and any religion.
It's kind of somewhere, it's not quite Reconstruction, it's not quite Reformed, but it's a little bit of Yeah, it's feels more like a reformed service. So there was a lot more.
Guitars? Do we have guitars?
No. Yeah, sometimes there's a guitar. Last night it was a flute and a choir. But you know, the one that I found to be a couple of things. I found actually, you know, I think I've mentioned this, but my wife is Jewish, I you know, in spite of my we both are finding a lot of redemption. This is both our second marriages, and it's not a commentary on what's come before at all. I think part of the richness of this relationship is born of broken things, right? And so I there's a lot of, I feel a lot of humility and grace and gratitude that I get to share my life with this person. And I, you know, the interesting thing, a couple of things I thought was interesting. A lot of, you know, they do a prayer. Now, my Hebrew is awful, and I blame it. At Princeton, we had a brilliant Hebrew professor, but he was from Singapore, Indonesia. So we all learned Hebrew with a with an Indonesian accent, which I don't know. That's just my blaming. But there's this wonderful, the Ashamnu is actually a confessional prayer that goes through the whole Hebrew alphabet. So there's sins for each letter, and part of the rabbi said in some levels it covers the whole of things, right? The, you know, by speaking each letter or speaking sins from each letter, it's symbolic of the whole, you know, language and word and things like that. So that's actually was very meaningful. There was a point where we do our quiet prayers, and I was thinking, well, what if I tried to do all my prayers? You know, if I tried to find a sin, each sin I've committed in English, and that was depressing too. It was actually more depressing in English than it was in Hebrew, but not so much depressing as like a time of really self-reflection. This really started with Rosh Hashanah, right? This idea of the new beginning, and there was a wonderful podcast. I don't remember if I mentioned it. I know I mentioned in a sermon. I know we talked about it here, our first podcast back. But Danielle Hartman on Shalom from Shalom Hartman on their Rosh Hashanah podcast. Really, this idea of it's a new beginning, right? We can leave things behind us, and so the reconciliation, forsaking of vows is only between you and God. So there's a sense where that there's a renounce. You get heaven's open for the week, and you get a do-over on the vows you made for God. You get released from your vows, but those vows are not between humans; it's between you and God. So I think I don't know if you have to ask forgiveness from people first. You certainly that's you go through that in all the confessional prayers, and they're long confessions, but there's still a sense of how you've wronged humans. It requires concrete actions before there can be forgiveness. Whereas God's forgiveness, if you would, when heaven is open from this Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur is kind of a one-sided grace. I mean, you have to have your heart open, but it doesn't cover the things that are wrong between you and humans. And that requires acts of penance and restoration and things like that. I'm still trying to understand that. And we're actually going to do an interfaith conversation the end of October up here on Christian and Jewish understandings of forgiveness, similarities, and things that are different. But it's been a really really interesting journey. These are the first time I've done these services, and I've found it very meaningful for me.
Is atonement possible? This is the question. Is it possible vicariously? This is very interesting. I was thinking a little bit today in preparation for our discussion, and I was rereading a little bit of Immanuel Kant. And of course, Kant thinks that vicarious atonement is impossible, that what's true is the concept of the new man, but the new man is the person that is truly repentant, right? So that then God can look at you differently. That there can actually be, God can be just in forgiving, in treating the sinner differently because of the sinner's changed disposition. They are reborn. So rebirth, I think, in Kant is something that happens. It is not something from John 3 that would happen in some once for all definitive sense through water and the Spirit or something like that. It is something that happens dispositionally, I suppose, every time you make amends.
Right.
But is this, I mean, I think this is one of the stumbling blocks for many people for Christianity, right? The idea that there is this concept of vicarious atonement that right. somehow that you're the atonement happens through the work of Christ and not solely by the subject, the moral subject who has the problem to begin with.
Right. You know, I find what's interesting, you and I we've talked about this. I'm sure we have talked about it directly, but this whole, it's like evangelicals or people trying to stop being evangelicals, have picked up the whole mantle that, about the blood sacrifice against the substitutionary view of atonement. We have talked about these folks, and it's funny, they're, you know, it's like they've gone where they've pronounced that, you know, that they've made the decision that there is no such, the substitutionary atonement was a bad idea. It doesn't exist. And, that God's mercy is just who God is, and that the cross has nothing to do with, the shedding of blood for forgiveness of sins. And, you know, it's interesting. And I think that, I understand why they're reacting to it. So, cause I certainly grew up in that kind of Christianity where it was the only view of the atonement that was presented. And we certainly, you know, we could talk about all kinds of abuses of it. I just find the unintended consequence of what neo-evangelicals are doing, or, you know, whoever's on the bandwagon against substitutionary atonement, they should go back and look at the history of what happened in liberal Christianity when that was eliminated. because I think it's a mystery, and I certainly, you know, the way, you know, God the Father, you know, angry God, God the Son, good God, so angry God the Father kills his Son because he's innocent. You know, it could be presented in a very crude ways.
This reminds me of the Simpsons episode where Bart figures out a way to project his voice into the Flanders children's bedroom. And he says, "Do you want an angry God or a happy God?" And the Flanders kid go, "Happy God, happy God, happy God."
but it's an interesting, I think what it ultimately does is, in the long run, again, I'm not, I don't think substitutionary atonement is the only way we should talk about it. I think
it's the only way. In fact, I'm going to mute your microphone if you say anything else. It's the only way. One atonement theory. I wish we had buzzers. I would just buzz you if you said anything else.
Yeah, I'm all in on that ransom. I like the idea of kicking down the gates of Hades, and I like that Jesus fooling the devil. I like that.
That was a movie by Mel Gibson, wasn't it? Ransom. Give me back my son.
I think it's just
Mel Gibson. By the way, you notice it's taken a while, but Mel Gibson's working again. He's doing films. I mean, Mel Gibson, I mean, I think the first thing Will Smith probably had to do was call Mel Gibson and be like, how long did I screw up for? Because Mel Gibson, he's being slowly rehabilitated.
Oh, well.
Very, very, you know, strange to talk about Mel Gibson on Yom Kippur, but, you know, here we go.
No, yeah, that's problematic on so many levels, my friend, so many levels. But any rate, now, so this idea of, yeah, I mean, there's a sense where I was part of a discussion the other day among it was about forgiveness, actually. And I was the only Christian in the room. And actually, I found that that's been very, as I was saying my prayers today, I realized that being the only Christian in the room means I keep my mouth shut. And I think that's probably a virtue I should have learned long time ago among my Christian fellows, because, you know, it doesn't matter if I don't always have to say what I'm thinking, and I don't have to say, even sometimes they looked at me, well, Bill, what do you think? And I go, oh, well, this is your discussion. I'm listening. And boy, if I had developed that virtue, as a young man, my life would have been very, very, very different. That was part of my, atoning for thinking about all the times where I felt the need to speak my mind when I should have kept it quiet. And, but now this idea of, I think there's a religious argument against this vicarious atonement. And there certainly is there's something really unnatural. I use those words purposely about the idea that God's grace is free and disinterested from how we act or respond to it. I think that's a powerful idea, but it's a counterintuitive one. That's why most Christians don't really believe in grace. There are Christians who believe in permissiveness. You know, everything's okay. All right. But I think there are Christians who say they believe in grace and forgiveness, that God really forgives, but they choose not to do that. So I think it's probably one of the more radical ideas that we believe and yet have kind of failed to fully practice.
I want to read to you something from Nicholas Walterstorff. And I think this is from, Reason, I think the book called Reason Within the Bounds of Religion Alone, which is sort of a playoff Kant's. It's a very short book, too. It's not long. It's, 120 pages or something like that. But he says this: God in the Kantian system wipes out the guilt of our wrongdoing if we present God with a good character. God is, in fact, morally required to do so. We have seen that such wiping out, if it were possible, would, in its indiscriminateness, raise a serious issue of justice. Further, we have seen that the claim that God can alter our moral status conflicts with Kant's repeated insistence that only we ourselves can do so. But in fact, such wiping out is not possible. Forgiveness is not the declaration that the guilty are no longer guilty, but the declaration that the guilty will no longer be treated as guilty. Forgiveness in that sense is eminently possible. When that occurs, morality is transcended. The forgiven have no moral claim on forgiveness. It comes to them as grace.
Yeah. Yes. That's powerful. I think that is. I think that's really the radical notion of our faith. I mean, I think that's, you know, it's part of the reason why the church never has fully been Pauline, right? It has trouble, you know. I'm preaching through Philippians this fall, and Philippians probably is one of the last books written. Although, you know, there's not enough time between the first and last for it really to matter a development of ideas. But the fact that Paul, this one of the most amazing statements that I've never spent much time on in preaching, but I did this week, was Paul says it doesn't matter to him why Christ is being preached, as long as it's being preached. And that's that kind of holy detachment.
I think that every time I watch Paula White on television.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. I never really thought of that her as Christian, but that might be. I have to rethink that.
Now everyone on this podcast has a scripture to look up when Joel Osteen pops on your TV.
Right. As long as that's Christ he's talking about. But again, I think that's an idea that comes from a person who is going deeper, maybe in the last months or year of his life, into what it means for him to be chosen by grace. I mean, and it's amazing to me how often Paul mentions that he, you know, was a persecutor. I mean, that's in the narrative. It's both in Paul's own talking of himself And it shows up also in Luke's version of the life of Paul and some of his discourses in the book of Acts. And I find that it takes such a radically such a radical wrongdoing of actually maybe killing Christians. I mean, he kind of says that it's a realization that in the midst of that, not in spite of that, in the midst of that is when he's called. He's actually on the way to throw women and men and maybe children in prison in Damascus. And that's precisely when he encounters the resurrected Christ. I still, the mystery of how radical that is, you know, may God give us the grace to go deeper in that. And I just think that's beyond transactional, you know, transactional. Certainly Paul spends the rest of his life, you know, living it out, right? And giving his life back to the one who saved his life. But I find that amazing. And I think I'm not sure that we have plumbed the depths of that. As a matter of fact, I'm sure we haven't. There are those who do, right? And those are people who love, those who've been forgiven much love much, right? But I think I look at my own sense of why I don't love God more. And I think it's because I still try to minimize and rationalize away the ways I have wronged others and myself and wronged God. And when I'm able to look at that, I found that's part of this journey for me this week, as I stand with my Jewish brothers and sisters, is to revisit some of the darker things in my life and being able to have the grace enough to see them now in ways I haven't before, and yet not to feel condemned. That's to me a mystery of what can only come from a one-sided act of grace.
Yeah, the question is, can you even visit that stuff without the light of grace? Like, can you even see the darkness without the light? Like, is it a prerequisite?
And it's interesting too. Don't you? You know, I've found that I do the spiral staircase, right? As I feel like grace has grown in my life, I actually have a more realistic view of my failures. And I think the grace in that is that if I could understand them, if I understood them back then the way I understand them now, it probably would have crushed me. And so there's a sense where even though you said, well, yeah, I asked for forgiveness and I experienced forgiveness, part of the meditation of me being the chief of all sinners or the least of the apostles is that meditation on what does it mean that I persecute the church? I think that's a meditation that he had that made him love more. It didn't destroy him. It just drove him deeper into humility and grace. And I think, you know, humility was not a natural virtue for the great apostle. It's certainly not a natural one for me. And I think it's only in being able to fully grasp the depth of our need that you know, we fall deeper in love with God. And yeah, I think, you know, it's something, I think the analogy is something we just had another grandchild in our family. Charlie Dillon was born on August the 13th. And my wife was talking to my daughter-in-law, and my daughter-in-law had a pretty rough delivery. Everybody's fine, but it was 48 hours that were unusually hard on something that's already inherently horribly hard. And they both were talking about how it kind of goes away when you hold your child. And it's kind of a holy forgetting, and that you, my wife is much more funny and graphic with her description of giving birth, because she's done it twice. But then she says, then you hold that alien looking creature and you only feel love.
Mm.
And that's a one-sided, there's a one-sided event. and so I think that that's, I think our Trinitarian monotheism and our understanding, radical understanding of grace is not only what this, what gives us distinction, but it's a message that we have to speak clearly and loudly. And anytime Christians, in the name of trying to be less offensive or not to trigger people or whatever, you know, whatever, however they say it, try to compromise either of those things, then we don't, we lose the power of the gift of freedom that we have to offer.
Yeah. This is like what Paul Zoll would say, right? He's been on the podcast. That anytime grace comes into contact with the law will always swallow it up. In that, and there's something to that, I think, in that the human need for control, the human need for accomplishment, the human need for self-justification, the temptation is always to go back to control. So I think there's something to the nature of the human condition that will always default to some sort of ledger-oriented system where you can put your own credits on the ledger somehow.
Yeah. Again, you know how I just struggle with those Lutheran lenses sometimes.
Hey, second half of 15:17. It's all there, Bill. It is all there.
But, you know, I think to me, I remember something Adagio's Allen said of blessed memory, that if we, those people say they really love justice, then if you really love justice, then you'd want it to fall on your own head first.
Absolutely.
And I think there, I think that's the radical, I think that is the radical nature of grace alone. Because none of us really want that. I think it's also that, I think you're right. That's the check, right? There's the, I'll grant the Lutherans, all the Lutherans are going to smile about what I'm about to say, but that's picking up the wrong Torah. That, you know, we each are to have our own Torah, right? And for those of us who believe in Jesus, you know, the Torah is the Torah of faith in Messiah Jesus, not faith in the Torah, right? That our Torah is faith in Jesus, not faith in the good gift of the law that God has given us. Because Paul himself says, even those of us who have followed the law have now laid that, you know, have embraced faith in Messiah Jesus, you know, first, right? And if we need that, then that's all we need. That's that, you know, that's alone. So I do believe that. And yet there's a sense where that's the problem, right? That's the problem of always the problem of social justice or any kind of justice, right? Because there's something we can all come up with that we can't forgive. That was what, you know, the Elie Wiesel was quoted the other night in a study group I was part of, and the idea that you can never forgive anyone who has killed children. And of course, talking and yeah, the idea that people could consciously send 2 million children to the gas chambers. But, you know, we're trying to create a peace treaty with Saudi Arabia, who just mowed down thousands of people on their border, which included children. And, you know, I find that, well, I'll just leave it there. I won't go down another road about the boldness of that statement. I certainly appreciate Elie Wiesel, and he's earned the right to say such things. But I don't, you know, you cannot forgive that, you can forgive the killing of adults, but not the killing of children. The rhetoric of it, I think that's the problem, right? We can pick up the most worst thing that has happened and all feel superior to that. You know, I think that's part of what's behind your constantly cautioning on playing the Hitler card, right?
Exactly. Right. I have an aversion to playing the Hitler card. You know, it's interesting. There's a book that came out years ago. I've read it several times, called Free of Charge by Miroslav Volf. The subtitle is Giving and Forgiving in a Culture Stripped of Grace. But in it, he explains something so elegantly and simply. He says that on the level of exchange, there are kind of three levels he sees. If you take something from me, or I take something from you with no regard for recompense, we call that theft. If you give me something and I give you something, and you know, maybe one of us thinks we got the slightly better deal, but there's no injustice, we call that an exchange. And that's mostly the kind of economy we live in, right? We hopefully avoid theft and, you know, stay within, in most of our economic relations, it's some form of exchange. And then he says, if you give me something, or I give you something with no expectations, truly no strings attached, NSA, as the young people say, then that is a gift. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because sometimes a gift, I remember my Aunt Edie was a very popular woman, my great aunt, and in our community, and she had people dropping off Christmas presents for her all the time. And she would have gifts, like gender neutral gifts that were unlabeled, so that she wouldn't, I think because she feared the gifts were some really exchanges. I mean, she didn't want to be the person that was given a gift and didn't have one back for somebody. It was really interesting, very interesting lesson to watch as a child. But Volf says on the level of human relations that theft is akin to revenge. That if I take something from you, if I seek to enact recompense from you, with no bearing on whether or not it's fitting and corresponds to the sort of wound or infraction that I've experienced, then it's theft. If we're trying to have some proximate recompense for the offense, this is the great lex talionis, right? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I mean, that's about just compensation, right? That the compensation should be just. It's not revenge, that there is a limit to recompense on the level of the wound. And he thinks that that's justice. So on the first level, you have revenge, then you have justice. And he says, forgiveness is akin to a gift. It's when you give something and it's unilateral and no strings attached. And that's what forgiveness really is. And right, in some sense, the forgiver pays a debt in some sense, right? Like lets the debt be gone. But it's interesting because I love what Walter Sturf says. It's the forgiven isn't innocent. They're just treated as though they're innocent, right? They're ever so. God, you could say that God really does save the ungodly, right? And in fact, in some sense, it's almost a prerequisite, right? That to fit the category, you have to first be in the ungodly category, which Christianity has taught is a universal category. But I think that's the interesting and scandalous thing, that the one way unilateral, no strings attached nature of forgiveness, I think, as you said before, is scandalous. And I think it's it becomes, again, I mean, go back to Kant. I mean, it's something that Kant tries to make sense of and can't quite make sense of it, right? Tries to make sense of it without a supernatural God, without tries to sort of take the mythology of Christianity and humanize it and rationalize it. And it eschews all rationality. Right. There's an understanding, as Augustine says, faith seeking understanding. There's a mysterious logic to it from inside the circle of faith, but it's not something that I think it's something that confounds moral philosophers and moralism and morality in general, because it is God is the justifier of the ungodly.
Well, and I think Christianity, as Kierkegaard resisted Kant, the temptation to reduce religion to morality, is something we all have to. Well, I thought it'd be appropriate to pray this prayer from. It's very familiar to those of us who are Christians, but it's part of the liturgy of this time as well. Psalm 51: Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sins.
Amen to that. And have a blessed Yom Kippur, the few hours left of it.
Yeah. God bless you, my friend, as well. Peace.
How about that episode of New Persuasive Words? Thanks so much for joining Scott and Bill. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and will join us next time. Till then, thanks for listening, and God bless.